Okay, thanks, Natalie. As Natalie said, my interest in negotiation goes back a long way. I was at Oxford for over 20 years and taught an elective on the MBA around negotiation. But my interest in negotiation actually goes back even before Oxford, when I was actually a negotiator for a trade union. I worked for a trade union and was negotiating with employers around pay and conditions of employment. So I have a long interest in negotiation and hope to share some of the tips that I picked up over the years. And I've called the session The Art and Practice of Negotiation, because negotiation is an art. It's not a science. There are no precise rules in terms of how you conduct negotiation. As we go through the presentation, you'll see that on many occasions and in relation to many issues, you have to make judgment calls. There's no right or wrong way of doing it. You have to make a judgment. So that's why negotiation is so interesting, and that's why I've called it an art. So the starting point for today's presentation is clearly when are we confronted with a negotiating situation? In other words, what conditions need to be in place for negotiation to actually commence? And here's a picture of Saddam Hussein, departed now. And when he was found by a group of American soldiers in a hole in the ground in the Iraqi desert, you'll be interested to know that his first words were, "I am president of Iraq and I am willing to negotiate." Now, I suppose the question one asks is, was Saddam Hussein under some illusion? He's surrounded by soldiers pointing a gun and he is suggesting that he wants to negotiate. Now, is that a negotiating situation? What are people's views? Anybody got a view? If it's not a negotiation, why not? And if it is, why is that a negotiation situation? Anybody got any views? Yeah. So you're saying it isn't for those reasons. Okay, so you're suggesting that maybe there's something to do with power here, which determines whether we've got a negotiating situation. The balance of power was so tilted towards a soldier with a gun that we can't conceivably view that as a negotiating situation, because Saddam Hussein had no countervailing power against that force. Is that what we're saying there? Yes. Certainly there was an issue to negotiate. I suppose the issue was whether he had the power and the countervailing force to negotiate over his life. Does anybody want to argue that this is a negotiating situation? Yeah. Yep. Why wasn't he shot, do you think? Right. So it's interesting. I mean, you're right. There's an issue there about power and guns and not appealing to have any power. But as you say, maybe he did have some power. Maybe he knew where the weapons of mass destruction, if they existed, although we know they didn't, may have resided. So maybe there is an issue there about him having knowledge and information which could be used to negotiate. So as a starting point, there's an issue about a negotiating situation involving some kind of rough balance of power between parties, having something that either side wants. This is a clip from The Life of Brian, which I'm sure you all know about.
How much, quick?
What?
It's for the wife.
Oh, 20 shekels.
Right.
What?
There you are.
Wait a minute. What? Well, we're supposed to haggle.
No, I've got to get...
What do you mean, no?
I haven't got time.
Well, give it back then. No, I just paid you.
What?
Yeah.
This bloke won't haggle.
Won't haggle?
All right, do we have to? Now look, I want 20 for that. I just gave you
20. Now, are you telling me that's not worth 20 shekels?
No.
Look at it. Feel the quality. That's none of your goat.
All right, I'll give you 19 then.
No, no, no. Come on, do it properly.
What?
Haggle properly. This isn't worth 19.
You just said it was worth 20.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Come on, haggle.
All right, I'll give you 10.
That's more like it. 10? Are you trying to insult me? Me with a poor dying grandmother? 10?
All right, I'll give you 11.
Now you're getting it. 11? Did I hear you right? 11? This cost me 12. You want to ruin me?
17?
No, 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 no. 17.
18?
No, no, you're going to 14 now.
All right, I'll give you 14.
14? Are you joking? That's what you told me to say.
Oh, dear.
Oh, tell me what to say, please. Offer me 14.
I'll give you 14.
He's offering me 14 for this.
15.
17. My last word. I won't take a penny less or strike me dead.
16.
Done. Nice to do business with you. Tell you what, I'll throw you in this as well.
I don't want it, but thanks.
Bert?
Yeah.
All right, all right, right.
Now, where's the 16 you owe me?
I just gave you 20.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's four I owe you then.
No, that's right, that's fine, that's fine.
No, hang on, I've got it here somewhere.
That's right, that's four for the gourd.
Four? For this gourd? Four? Look at it. It's worth 10 if it's worth a shekel.
You just gave it to me for nothing.
Yes, but it's worth 10.
All right, all right.
No, 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 no. It's not worth 10. You're supposed to argue. 10 for that, you must be mad. Oh, well, one born every minute.
Okay, so there was an example where the two parties actually had difficulty in getting a negotiation going, because one of them was prepared to agree straight away. There was no conflict or difference of opinion. At the outset, there was an agreement that he would actually pay the sum to buy... Oh, how's this going? This mouse is not working. Is Adrian up there? Yeah, there, we got it. Okay. So initially there was no negotiating situation because the two agreed. And a negotiating situation requires conflict. It requires a difference of view. If the two parties agree on something, clearly we've got no negotiation. So some of the tenets or basic premises of negotiation are beginning to emerge. Here is a definition that Putnam and Roloff gave of negotiation. Two or more interdependent parties who perceive incompatible goals and engage in social interaction to reach a mutually satisfying outcome. Now, let's unpack that definition a little bit to see what the key preconditions of negotiation are. So, first of all, the parties to the negotiation have to be or are interdependent. And that's important because the two parties need each other. You are not going to be present at a negotiation, you're not going to be involved in negotiation, unless you want something from the other party. And you should never lose sight of the fact that you are negotiating with somebody else because you want something from them, and they want something from you. So there's an interdependent relationship in a negotiating situation. Another key term is around perceiving. So the parties perceive incompatible goals. And negotiation is a lot about perception. Perception is often a reality. How the different parties view the world, how they view their relationship, is a crucial aspect of negotiation. And a crucial aspect is going to be manipulating the perceptions of the other party involved in the negotiation. So perceptions are crucial in a negotiating situation. As I've already hinted at, incompatibility of goals is a crucial or a key precondition. Clearly, if you agree, as the Monty Python characters did in that clip, there is no negotiation. The seller had to encourage the buyer to actually disagree with him. Where we have incompatible goals, there is conflict. And where conflict exists, power comes into play as a way of resolving how that conflict actually pans out. So negotiations involve incompatible goals, they involve conflict, and the exercise of power. Social. A negotiating situation is a social interaction. And a crucial thing to remember about a social situation is there's more than one person involved. You're negotiating with somebody else. So you always need to be aware and sensitive to the other side, to the people you're negotiating with. Where are they coming from? What are their interests? What kind of levers can you use to change their mind? So always remember that negotiation has another party, at least one other party involved. And I suppose the final interesting feature of that definition is a suggestion that negotiations actually conclude with a mutually satisfying outcome. In other words, negotiations are not all about screwing the other side. The sign of a good outcome, a good negotiation, is often that both sides go away feeling they've got something out of it. So those are the kind of preconditions for a negotiating situation. Two parties who want something from each other, where they're perceived to have incompatible goals, which suggests power and conflict come into play. The social dimensions of that negotiation, which suggests that you need to be aware and sensitive to the other side, and an outcome which is seen as mutually satisfying. In other words, both sides get something out of it. Okay, so what I'm going to do in this talk is look at negotiations along three dimensions. Firstly, we're going to look at context. So I'm going to be suggesting that there are no golden, simple rules which guide negotiation, that the way you conduct negotiations depends a lot upon circumstances and the conditions that you're in. So we'll look at context in those terms. Secondly, I'll go through different negotiating strategies, identify those and what they mean for behaviours, and finally talk briefly about some negotiating tactics that may be linked to those strategies, if that makes sense. Okay, now, dealing then with context, the first of those three themes, I think it would be fair to say that negotiations, all negotiations, have or should have a kind of implicit structure. It's not always formalised, but implicitly there is a structure there, and arguably, prescriptively, that should be the structure. So preparation. It's crucial in any negotiation to be prepared, to be ready with information, arguments, and a strategy in place. Then you present your arguments to the other side, they present theirs, you begin to bargain, and then you come to a settlement, or you abandon that negotiation because walking away is always an option, and once you've settled, you finally agree. So those are, if you like, the building blocks of any negotiation which should be there, but I'm suggesting to you that the way in which those different components is actually carried out depends a lot upon context. It depends on the form of the negotiation, the nature of the negotiation that you're involved in. It depends upon power, the power balance between the different sides. And thirdly, it depends upon relationships, the kind of relationship you have with the parties or party that you're negotiating with. So I'll go through those three contextual factors in turn, just unpacking what they mean for negotiations. So starting with the form of the negotiation. Firstly, one needs to be aware of who one is negotiating with. So you may have an individual negotiation, which is a one-to-one negotiation. In that Monty Python clip, it was clearly an individual negotiation, one party negotiating with one other individual. However, often negotiations are collective. We're dealing with teams of negotiators. And in business, you often have a team of negotiators which may comprise, for example, people from managers from different functions and negotiating with a company who also has a team of negotiators. And as we'll see a little bit later on, that's clearly very important because when you're dealing with a negotiating team, a whole range of issues arise in terms of how you manage that team, how you align the goals of that team, and how you deal with another side which may also have a team of negotiators. So who's negotiating is a crucial contextual factor. What are we negotiating about? Again, one can distinguish between one-off and recurring negotiations. That Monty Python clip was a one-off negotiation, one suspects. I don't think he was going to go back and buy another beard. Often negotiations take place on an issue with a person or a group of you you'll never see again. You go and buy something, and then you walk away and never see them again. At the same time, you might be negotiating with people on a recurring basis. So, for example, when you negotiate over pay, when I negotiated over pay, every year I turned up and saw the same people to negotiate another pay increase. And clearly there are very different issues that arise depending upon whether it's a recurring or a one-off negotiation. If it's a recurring negotiation, you may be very sensitive to not upsetting the other side too much because you know you're going to have an ongoing relationship with them and you know you're going to turn up in a year's time to negotiate again. So you really don't want to upset them. You may be more cavalier in a one-off negotiation. You might try your luck a bit more in a one-off negotiation on the basis that you may never see that person again. I'm not saying one-off negotiations inevitably involve cavalier behaviour because reputation and so on matter, but these different sorts of situations may generate different sorts of behaviour. When? So what is the time scale for a negotiation? Sometimes negotiations are very compressed. We've got a train strike coming up in London, and the parties are trying to negotiate an agreement before that strike takes place, which is 9:30 tonight. So they're going to be actually trying very hard. They're under pressure to get an agreement, and it may generate behaviours which aren't necessary or required if you've got a much longer time frame where you can consider issues, where you can do your research, where you can mull over different options. So the time that you have, short or long time frames, will again affect your behaviours. And finally, where are you negotiating? Now, I'm not going to have time today to talk very much about cross-cultural issues in negotiation, although that's clearly a very important issue. Whether you're negotiating in a culture that you're familiar with, or whether you're negotiating overseas with a different type of cultural environment, will affect how you behave. So, for example, this is a question that was put to managers in three or four different countries. This is an example of a hypothetical situation, and this proposition was put to managers in different countries with different cultures. An employee has worked for the company for 15 years, excellent performance over that time, but unsatisfactory over the last year. If there's no reason to expect performance will improve, which do you agree with? And this was a statement which said the employee should be dismissed on the grounds that job performance should remain the grounds for dismissal, regardless of age or previous record. There was another option which said that the employee should be kept on. But if you look at these responses, 75% of US and Canadian managers agreed with that statement, whereas only 30% of Japanese, French, Italians, and Germans agreed with that statement. So when one goes and negotiates overseas, there are cross-cultural issues to consider. That's an interesting sign, just to illustrate cross-cultural differences. What does that sign mean? Well, if you're English, you think it means something's good. That's pretty good. However, in Italian, they use that sign to mean one. In Japanese, five. And Greeks mean up yours. So if you go to Greece, you're not going to do that. So you just have to be sensitive to cultural context. So where you negotiate is clearly important. Okay, let's look at relationships now, which is the second contextual factor. And there are a whole range of issues, again, which kick in contextually to affect negotiation. The first point to note is that negotiations are multidimensional. One needs to be aware that there's a negotiation about the substance of what you want and what you're trying to get from each other, but there's also a kind of shadow negotiation which is also taking place. So when one negotiates, one clearly is concerned with substance, getting what you require from the other side, but you all the time need to be aware of the shadow aspect of negotiation, which is about the interpersonal. You're negotiating a particular relationship with the person that you're bargaining with. And you need to be aware of your communication processes and the way in which you engage with the other side. So negotiation is not only about the substance, it's about the negotiation of a particular relationship, which could be significant, particularly if you continue to have a connection with that organisation or that person. So, for example, in joint venture negotiations where two companies are coming together to launch a joint venture, negotiating the terms of that venture, joint venture, are not only about the substance of that arrangement, but the relationships that you negotiate with the other side can be very important as well. So this author here who's done research on joint ventures suggests strategy implementation will be a more or less conflictive affair depending upon the outcome of the negotiating process, as it represents and determines the basis of their subsequent function of the partnership. So the way in which you deal with each other in negotiating the substance of the joint venture affects your future relationship with that other party. So one should all the while be aware of the kind of relationship you're building up with the other side. So you might want to slag them off or abuse them if you know that in the future you're going to have to work and establish a relationship with them. Knowing the other side. Now, do you know the people that you're negotiating with? Clearly, if you haven't met the other party, if you don't know anything about them, the process of negotiation, possibly the outcome, are going to be very different to circumstances where you know that person very well. Maybe where you know that person very well, you can take things for granted, you know where they're coming from, you know what kind of meanings they're attaching to certain phrases. Where you haven't met that person before, clearly you're going to be much more precautionary, much more careful, much more probing in how you deal with a negotiation, particularly early on. So whether you know that person is clearly a crucial contingent factor, as is whether you trust them, which is closely linked to whether you know them or not. Do you trust that person if they say something? Possibly if you've known them for many years and know that they deliver on their promises, yes. But if you don't know them, again, it's somewhat more questionable. Do you respect? Now, you should try and respect the other side in a negotiation. And this little clip shows what happens when respect breaks down.
Without raising our voices, all right? Now, at a reasonable decibel level, can you tell me what exactly the issue is here?
Okay. We at the WGA do not feel that the AMPTP is taking these negotiations seriously.
Do you mind if we ask on what you're basing that assertion?
Okay, it's any number of things.
There's the fact that your side hasn't really moved at all as far as the numbers are concerned.
That's right, and we were under the assumption that you guys were coming back to the table in good faith.
And any progress that's been made has been largely superficial.
Can I just jump in here for a second and point out what the real issue is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. By all means.
We feel that the level of commitment by the AMPTP is more or less reflected in the caliber of counsel it chooses to assign to a negotiation.
Go on.
We don't feel that the choice of counsel reflects a serious attitude towards the guild's demands. That, essentially, is the elephant in the room.
You're questioning our legal credentials?
In a nutshell, yes.
That is unbelievably presumptuous.
I don't think it is.
And why is that?
Because you're puppets.
Excuse me, sir. I am a graduate of Harvard Law School, class of 1984. I finished at the top of my class and worked as a lawyer for Goldman Sachs for 6 years.
How is that even possible? You're a monkey.
Yeah, and you're a Jew, so what?
I'm only half Jewish.
Oh, well, I'm only half monkey. The other half is squirrel.
You know what? Fuck you, monkey squirrel.
No, fuck you, right. Jew. Look, I'm not used to having my professional credibility questioned, all right?
So, you're saying you all have law degrees?
That's correct.
Okay. What's the name on your diploma?
My name is on my diploma. Stephen Callahan.
What about you?
Alan Ridgedale.
These are your real names? What about you?
Mr. Kibbles the dog. But that's just what I use on my business cards. My real name is Michael Shipley.
All right, well, let me ask you this, then. What about the guys behind the table with their hands up your asses? Do they all have law degrees?
No, they're puppeteers, dickhead.
You're a little...
Again, this is all getting nowhere.
Guys, let's try and get this thing back on the rails, okay?
No, we're not negotiating until the AMPTP assigns legitimate counsel to these proceedings.
Well, then, we got a little problem here, don't we?
Yeah, we do, because we're not budging until we get our 4 cents from legitimate, authorized AMPTP representatives.
Well, how about we stick that 4 cents up your assholes?
Oh, Christ, Alan.
No, this is a legitimate pitch. How about we stick that 4 cents up your assholes, and if you can fish it out with your thumb and forefinger in less than 20 seconds, it's yours.
All right, we'll take that deal.
Sounds good.
It sounds great.
Oh. All
right.
Great.
Okay.
All right,
so
terrific. Far. Good.
Thank you, guys.
Great.
Thanks.
Let's go make Bionic Woman.
Terrific. All right.
Hey,
all right.
Thanks,
that was going to be a lot tougher than that.
That was great. No, thank
we
you.
Did it.
We figured it out.
Who
knows?
You guys
Kudos,
are good at what you guys are good at. Can we do that here, or do we go somewhere?
Okay, so that's what happens when respect breaks down, although it did break out in the end. I suppose the final issue about relationships is gender, whether you're negotiating with men and women. And this is obviously quite a sensitive area, which I'm not going to actually venture into for fear of upsetting anybody. But I suppose there is an issue about whether men and women negotiate differently, and there is quite a bit of research about on this issue. I mean, here are a number of statements which the research has commented on. Women cooperate more than men. True or false? Well, yes, there is a small but significant difference here, which suggests that women do cooperate more than men. There's also evidence suggests that women are initially more trusting, but less willing to forgive. And we all know. Yeah, they're quite provocative. I mean, we all know about the second one, don't we? Women set lower aspirations. Is that true or false? Well, actually, there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that women do set lower aspirations when they go into negotiations. So management students, this was a bit of research done in the US, men expected to earn 13% more than women in their first year and 32% over their career. So there is an issue about aspiration and expectation. Women don't ask, and that's another one. Women are 45% more likely than men to score low on a scale designed to show that life is amenable to change via negotiation. So there are some interesting gender differences, which, if we had more time, we could obviously discuss. Okay, so moving on to the third contextual feature, which is all about power. So the point here is that the nature of your negotiation would depend upon the balance of power between the different parties. And we talked a little bit about this around Saddam Hussein. And there are different ways in which one can actually assess power in a negotiating situation. I mean, in a general sense, power, and there have been books and books and books written on definitions of power, but very crudely and broadly, power is the capacity to exert influence over another party. The issue is, how do you generate that capacity to exert influence? Here are three kind of generalized ways in which you might define power and use power in a negotiating situation. So the first one is based on cost, the second one is based upon environmental contingencies, and the third one, possibly the most interesting and important, is based upon dependency. So I'm not going to deal with quotes. I mean, power as a cost. I mean, this is quite a rational approach to power, which is saying that bargaining power depends upon the disadvantages your opponent suffers, or thinks they suffer, perceives that they will suffer, if they disagree with your proposal, relative to the disadvantages suffered if they agree with your proposal. So there's a kind of rational calculation to be made here, which suggests that you have power if the cost to the other side is greater if they disagree than if they agree with what you want. So cost kicks in to the extent that you have power if the costs of the other side are greater if they disagree than if they agree. And just to give you an example of this, so A's bargaining power relative to B is related to the cost to B of disagreeing with A versus the cost of B agreeing with A. So if A's claim would cost £10,000 to B, the cost of disagreeing is £11,000, then clearly A has power to secure their claim. A is powerful when the value of the equation is greater than one, and in that case it clearly is. So if the costs can be calculated, and that's a big if, because the cost of actually conceding and giving the other side what they want can be quite difficult. There are often certain uncertainties. But if you can calculate costs and put that forward as a rationale for succeeding or giving you your claim, then that can be quite a powerful mechanism to get what you want. The lesson there is, in negotiations, you're trying to persuade your opponent that it is in their own best interest to accept your claim or offer, as the alternative, a rejection, is more costly. And remember, we're dealing with perception, so you can work up the kind of cost of the other side of disagreeing and stress how much more cost-effective it is to agree. So think about costs and relative costs of your claims. The second view of power is much more to do with objective reality. I mean, power is not only about perceptions, but it's also about external context. So your power may depend on the political situation. So, for example, there may be certain issues which generate public opinion which may support your claim. So when firefighters went on strike 5 or 6 years ago, there was initially quite a lot of public support for firefighters. Here were men and women who risked their lives on a daily basis to rescue you from fires, and this significantly bolstered the claim of the firefighters. There may be economic considerations here. So, for example, levels of inflation, levels of unemployment may affect your power in negotiating a pay increase. If unemployment levels are quite low, then it actually bolsters the power of the union because employers can't get alternative sources of labour. So economic circumstances are important, as is regulation. Issues simply around, for example, the law. So, for example, in my background is trade unions, and the law regulates strike activity in quite a tight way, and that will affect the extent to which the strike weapon can be used by workers to pursue their claims. And there are also internal factors to consider as well. For example, around technology. Sometimes, for example, employees who actually hold a very important pivotal position in a technological process have quite a lot of power. So the person who switches the machines on, only he can do it, has quite a bit of power. Product markets as well might be important. So, for example, how perishable is your product? Again, my background is in trade unions, and historically, print unions, the people who produced newspapers, had quite a lot of power over the newspaper owners, because you can only have one day's newspapers. Once that day has gone, you can never get it back. So you can never have another July the 21st, 2014. Once you've lost that day's newspaper, you can never get it back. And that's why the print unions had quite a lot of power over newspaper owners to actually push their pay claims. So those kind of internal and external factors will affect power balance between different sides. And it suggests that if you're involved in negotiation, you systematically need to assess the constraints and choices that you have given those environmental features. Does the law actually allow you to take action? Do you have public support? How much power does somebody have given the kind of product you're producing? And there is a real world out there, so it's not just about perception. The law is the law, and you can't dodge it, basically, however much you might like to. Finally, then, dependence as a way of establishing power. And this view of power suggests that the limits of your bargaining power are set by the negotiator's interdependence. How interdependent are you? And the more the other side is dependent on you, the greater your bargaining power. And that means that power is significantly influenced in this context by what is called the BATNA, which is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Now, the BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, is your walk-away position. In other words, if you were to leave that negotiation, what would you walk away to? Now, if you can walk away to something that's quite attractive, whereas the other side walks away to something which is very unattractive, then clearly you have much more bargaining power than the other side. So your BATNA is a crucial determinant of power. What do you have to walk away to if the negotiations break down? Donald Trump, who we all know and have mixed views about, suggests that the art of the deal is to find out what the other party wants, because if you have it, you've got a deal. If you've got that, what they want, if they are dependent upon you for that, it gives you considerable power. So a couple of examples of how BATNAs have kicked in. This was Formula One in 2009. Max Mosley, who headed the Formula One Association, who ran Formula One, was caught doing rather strange things on the front page of the Sun. A lot of scandal around Max Mosley doing really odd things, dressed in very strange clothes, was beginning to bring Formula One into ridicule. And the car manufacturers wanted to get rid of Max Mosley. So what did they do? They tried to create their own BATNA, which is a walking away from the Formula One setup that existed. So the car makers threatened to break away. So they created their own BATNA, and very soon Mosley goes, and the breakaway threat is ended. Another example, quite a high-profile example from 2 or 3 years ago, was Guy Hans, who you may have picked up on, who was head of Terra Firma, which is a private equity firm, and quite a big legal case, because what happened there was Terra Firma and Guy Hans were trying to buy EMI, and Citigroup were brokering this deal. And Citigroup suggested that there was an alternative offer for EMI, and that alternative offer prompted Guy Hans to actually up his bid. So what Citigroup were effectively doing was establishing a BATNA, somebody else who would buy EMI if Terra Firma didn't. Now, it subsequently transpired that that alternative bid was a fraud. Citigroup had made it up. They'd made up the suggestion of an alternative bid, and there was legal action that followed because it was suggested by Guy Hans that this was fraud. What Citigroup were doing was trying to establish a BATNA, an alternative to Terra Firma buying EMI and therefore bolstering their power position. And actually, Guy Hans initially lost that court case. It was deemed not to be fraud. So quite an interesting example of trying to establish a BATNA. So the lessons of this are, you always need to know what your BATNA is. So as a negotiator, think what your walkaway position would be. If you didn't get an agreement, what would you be left with? What would be your alternatives? If that BATNA is weak, then you will want to strengthen it. So, for example, you're negotiating with a contractor or commissioner for a particular contract. Well, you might go away and provide and seek other providers or other contracts to try and boost your position if this one fell through. You also need to identify what the other side's BATNA is, if you can. And if you can identify it, then you will clearly want to weaken it because that will strengthen your position. You think, you might be saying to the other side, you think there are other contractors who can provide this service for you. Well, we know there aren't. We've done some research and we know that we're the best provider of this particular service and that there are very few other suppliers that could offer the quality of service we could. And what you're doing there is you're weakening their alternatives, you're weakening their BATNA, and in so doing, strengthening your own position. You need to be aware, though, how that actually finding the BATNA is not always straightforward. I mean, it's often quite difficult to identify options, particularly on the other side. There is a tendency to overestimate your BATNA. Oh, we've got lots of other options. Be careful not to overestimate what's available to you. And there's a similar tendency to underestimate what the other side can do, what other options they've got. So just be aware of that. And also be aware that BATNAs may change over time. Negotiations often take place over a period of time. And in that period, BATNAs change. Sometimes their BATNA may strengthen, yours may weaken over time. So BATNAs are a crucial aspect of power. Okay, so we've looked at context. What I'm going to do now is move on to strategies. Just to give you an overview, clearly it's very important in negotiations to try and align these different elements. What are you trying to achieve in negotiations? Be clear what your goals are. Once you know what your goals are, think about how you're going to achieve them, which is your strategy. Ensure that the style that you adopt and the behaviours you adopt support that strategic approach. Okay, so goals. Tangibility. Sometimes goals are intangible as well as being tangible. Issues of reputation, for example. try to establish good relationships with the other side. These are intangible goals which you need to be aware of and which we've already talked a little bit about. This is an example of the workers in Denmark who went on strike. These were factory workers at Carlsberg, and they went on strike because traditionally Carlsberg had allowed its workers to take cans of beer off the production line and drink them anytime they liked while they were working. So anytime you fancied a drink, you could just pick it up and have one, which was a great perk. The only condition was, of course, you couldn't be drunk on the job, otherwise you'd lose your job. But as long as you stayed sober, you were fine to take a drink. And Carlsberg, and I know most of us would like to work at Carlsberg, but Carlsberg took away that privilege, and it clearly upset the workers who went on strike. So we need to be aware that sometimes goals are intangible as well as tangible. We've talked about focus, what kind of relationships you want to build. We need to be clear about goals in terms of approach, interests v. positions. And this is a contrast which is often drawn. One needs to be clear the difference between an interest and a position. Often when negotiations get stuck, it's because the two sides take a position. They get stuck in their demands, and these demands appear to be incompatible with one another. It's much better to step away from a position to see what exactly your interests are, so that you can find other ways of addressing those interests beyond the positions that you take. So positions get you stuck into what you want. Interests argue that you step away. How can we achieve these ends through different means? So be aware of the difference between an interest and a position. And finally, when it comes to goals, you need, as a negotiator, to begin to prioritise what your goals actually are. Because by prioritising, you can identify what kind of issues you don't care that much about. These are throwaway issues. Maybe they become bargaining chips. Right the way up to essential goals, which you know are breaking points for you. These are walk-away issues. If you don't get this, then there's no deal. So what are your deal breakers? What are your essential goals for the negotiation? And this is often described as your sticking point. This is the point where you won't go any further, and you need to be clear about what that point actually is. So it's often quite useful as an exercise just to think, well, what is my sticking point? What is the realistic possibility in this negotiation, and what would be the best case scenario? This is just a way of structuring your thoughts, but clearly the sticking point is a very important bottom line. And the sticking point is very important because the respective sticking points will determine where the zone of potential agreement actually is. So, for example, in this case, the sticking point, say they're buying, a car here, the sticking point for the buyer is £20,000. In other words, the buyer is not going to pay more than £20,000 for that particular product. And for the seller, the sticking point is £10,000. And because we get those respective sticking points, the agreement is going to lie between £10,000 and £20,000. That is the zone of the potential agreement. It can't be higher than 20K, obviously, because the buyer won't go for it. And it can't be lower than 10K because the seller won't sell it for that lower price. So that is the zone of potential agreement, which is clearly an important area because it determines where the deal will actually lie. I don't know if you can see that, but this is an example. I often do an exercise which is buying and selling a car. And here are some hypothetical figures, three buyers and three sellers. And here is the final price for the car, £8,000. £10,000 and £8,000. Now you might say, well, who is the best negotiator there? And you might say, well, the best seller is the one who got £10,000. This is for the same car. £10,000 looks like that seller did very well. And who is the best buyer? Well, that buyer looked to have done very well because they got it for the cheapest price. But one needs to be slightly careful in making that judgment. Those are the two who seem to have done best. Here are those same figures, and what one needs to be aware of in working out who's done well in negotiation is where are the relative sticking points? So if you look a bit more closely at that 10,000 car, who seems to be the best seller, well, actually, the sticking point for that buyer was £12,000. In other words, the buyer would have been prepared to pay £12,000 for that car, and they got it for £10,000. And therefore, the difference between the sticking point and the final figure was £2,000. So actually, didn't do so well. If you look at the buyer who got it for £6,000, well, there, the sticking point was £5,000, and the difference was £1,000. So they could have actually got it for £1,000 cheaper. So what appeared to be the best seller and the best buyer, when you look at the sticking points, you kind of slightly change your judgment. Now, I'm not saying you should ever push the other side to the sticking point, but that is what they could have got that car for. And just to give you an example of how sticking points work.
I'm just saying, telling the truth is not in the cards right now. I thought you'd be excited to have an acting job.
If it's an acting job, we should get paid.
Yeah, you're going to get paid in experience.
I want to actually get paid.
All right, what do you want?
$600 for the day, plus overtime if we go over 8 hours. I'll do my own hair and makeup, and I want you to pay for the 6-week intensive acting camp that my mom can't afford.
$50 for the day and a 2-week acting class at the YMCA nearest you.
$500 and a 4-week acting class.
$300 and a 3-week class.
Done.
I would have done it for $500.
I would have done it for the experience.
So there was an example of the respective sides not going to their sticking points. Okay. Strategic choices, I'll do this very quickly. One needs to be aware of different choices, strategic choices when one goes into negotiations. Three main strategic choices that need to be made, suggested by Wharton and McKersey, described as distributive, integrative bargaining, and intra-organizational bargaining. Now, distributive bargaining is a zero-sum game. You go into the negotiation on the basis that there must be a winner and there must be a loser. There's no kind of win-win situation here. We're dealing with a fixed pie, and if I get a bigger slice of that pie than you, then I am a winner and you are a loser. So distributive bargaining involves parties competing to determine the division of limited resources. There's a win-lose situation. Parties approach each other as adversaries. So you have to decide whether you're going to go into negotiation on the basis of a distributive approach. And this is an example of a distributive approach. Clearly, the more that U gains, the less M gets. So this is a kind of situation where U gets that and M gets a higher amount, or U gets that, which is quite a bit, and M gets less. So this is a distributive situation. Integrative bargaining is a win-win situation, where you can both gain from the negotiation. You may have shared problems that you need to solve, or you may be trying to create a bigger pie. So here, negotiation involves cooperation, a concern with the problems by which joint regulation can increase joint gains. The parties look for shared or compatible interests behind declared positions. And this is an example of where both sides are getting exactly the same from the negotiation. Now, integrative situations might be viewed as slightly idealized, so we need to look at different sorts of integrative bargaining. The best case scenario would be Pareto optimal, where both sides get maximum value out of the negotiation. That's quite a rare situation, but there may be situations where you have a superior agreement, which creates added value for both sides, or in point of fact, an integrative bargain may simply involve the two sides both getting above their sticking points to a satisfactory degree. So that's distributive and integrative bargaining. And the important thing about distinguishing between distributive and integrative bargaining is the kind of approach you adopt affects your behaviours. So clearly, if you're adopting an integrative approach, you're much more open with the other side, whereas if you're adversarial and distributive, you hide information. Integrative bargaining involves you trading valued interests, whereas distributive bargaining involves you sticking to your interests. So here are a range of behaviours which should follow according to the strategic approach you adopt. And I think more than anything else I find from students and managers involved in negotiations is they don't think about what the behavioural implications are of their different strategic options. So you'll see the two sides going in and being really aggressive and adversarial towards each other, and you ask them, well, which approach are we adopting, distributive or integrative? And they say, well, actually, it's integrative. And yet their behaviours are completely out of line with their strategic option. So be aware of what strategic options are and make sure you align your behaviours accordingly. Finally, there's an issue of style. This is a framework which is often used to assess style. Style can be determined along two dimensions. To what extent are you concerned with your own outcomes, and to what extent are you concerned with other outcomes? And you can actually, if we had more time, we can assess your bargaining style. If you're concerned with your own outcomes and the other side's, then it's called collaborating. If you're not concerned with anybody's outcomes, not even your own, let alone the other side, it's called avoiding. So there are ways of assessing bargaining style by reference to what extent you're interested in the other side's objectives. Final strategic option is intra-organisational bargaining. And the notion of intra-organisational bargaining is merely drawing attention to the fact that often, particularly when you're involved in team negotiations, you will have to bargain with your own team. You will have to look inside your own team and actually bargain with them over their goals. So within any bargaining team, you will have goal dispersal. Your team may be made up of an HR director, a marketing director, an operating director. They will have different interests, different goals. You will need to resolve and align the goals in your own team before you confront the other side and make sure you retain a united front. Okay, now the third area I'm going to cover, and I'll do it very briefly because of time, is to do with tactical rules. And there are a whole range of rules that you need to be aware of when it comes to bargaining. And as I say, I haven't got a lot of time to go through these. Openings. Rules around openings. There's an important issue about agendas. Agendas are very important in negotiation because agendas set the structure for that negotiation. So you'll need to think carefully about constructing your own agenda and also responding to agendas that are put to you. Are all the issues there that you want to discuss? Are there issues that you want to put on there? Are the issues on that agenda framed in the way that you want? An extreme position. Often when you get to negotiation, both sides have uncertainty about who's going to make the first offer, and particularly how extreme should the offer be. An extreme position, going in with a really over-the-top demand, the pros and cons of that particular approach. Here's a clip from The Apprentice. And this is The Apprentice with Alan Sugar. And these guys were going to negotiate the price of a buffet, a meal, with a company. And they were wondering exactly where to pitch their opening offer. And we can see what happened in this particular case.
Hey, buddy, all right?
With regards to price,
we want it to go no lower than £60 per head.
No lower than that.
It's high, lad. I think that's high.
You're obviously going to have to see what the fella's like. But we're thinking £3,000 for the package.
But we don't want to.
We don't want to go in and undersell ourselves.
But we don't want to look like dicks, either. That's the problem, Rock. I think you're a mile away, mate.
I understand exactly what you're saying, Phil.
But I think a fair price. We're in central London. They're a big firm. If we pitch too low, he's going to negotiate you down. I think we might undersell ourselves.
Cheers, bud.
Bye.
It's a bit high, man. But we're going to have to do what else can we do, man?
You're looking £10 a canopy, nearly.
Again, Philip will lead the negotiation.
We had sort of put a cost in at around £65 per head, and that would include a selection of canapés, including two sweet canapés, six savoury, plus your stuff for the evening. I don't know how that sounds to you.
I think you would need to seriously rethink that costing. Yeah.
This is what you would consider for sit-down, three-course dinner.
Yeah.
As far as pricing is concerned.
We looked at something that was going to be around bear with me one moment. Let's get realistic. If we're talking sort of £35 per head. No?
Not in the least.
No? Not even close. Right. So if we went down to something like £17.50 a head, and looking at that sort of figures, I think it's incredibly realistic.
I'm still unimpressed.
I think we're going to find it very difficult to stack up at anything lower than around £15 a head.
That sounds feasible, I think. We can justify that.
Yeah.
So we've got a deal at £15 per head?
Yes, we'd be happy to go with that.
Well, that was absolutely hideous.
Yeah, that did not go.
We spoke them on the phone. We told them it was too high. Rocky is the gaffer, and he told us that's what he wanted to go down.
We were looking at complete prats.
Not good.
So from 65 to 15 is probably not that good. So extreme positions you need to treat with care. Extreme positions can affect your credibility. If you go in too high, it affects your credibility. It can undermine your relationship with the other side as well. Sometimes extreme positions can be used because if you're splitting the difference on a deal, clearly the higher you start, the clearly a broader basis for splitting the deal. But you need to treat extreme positions with extreme care. Rules around pace, I'm not going to go through these in detail because of the time. They're an issue about how quickly you push negotiations on. Sometimes you want to speed things up. Sometimes you want to slow things down to give the other side a chance to ruminate on what you've offered. So think about the pace of your negotiations. There are also rules about concessions. So think carefully about how you make concessions. Often you make conditional concessions. I will give you this if you give me something else. So linking concessions, linking items is very important. There are rules around pressures, the use of threats and bluffs. Salami slicing is quite a common tactic where you take issues one at a time and try and resolve them, and once you've resolved them, move on, rather than trying to get the deal over the whole package. Sometimes dealing with issues one at a time can actually move the negotiations on. There may be issues about information. Make sure you acquire information, you continually improve and update your information, and trying to think of ways of getting information from the other side. So testing the water, making a suggestion like a shot in the dark, which may elicit information from the other side. And finally, there are issues about people, about framing and anchoring and body language, as I've already hinted at, kick in negotiations. So think about the way in which you frame your proposals, presenting them positively. So, for example, this glass is half full rather than half empty as a way of presenting issues in a positive way. And think about how you communicate. And I've already said that body language is very important. This is a very famous piece of work which say that the communication of feelings and emotions is mainly achieved through body language, only a third through the voice and only 7% in content. So think heavily about your body language. And clearly, body language tells us a lot. I mean, George Bush looks bored, and he's bored about most things. This is a caring person. The body language shows that. I'm not sure what this one is showing, puzzlement and uncertainty, possibly. Okay, I suppose the final rule of negotiation, and this is by way of concluding my talk, is that you always, in negotiations, need to summarise and confirm what your deal actually is. So at the end of negotiations, you summarise and confirm. And that is crucial. You don't want the different parties to walk away from a negotiation with different ideas about what that deal actually is. You want to ensure that there are no ambiguities and misunderstandings in a negotiation which may come back to haunt you. So at the end of a negotiation, summarise what the agreement is and confirm that both parties are in agreement. And so by way of summarising this talk, what I've tried to do is give you a feel for negotiations by looking at context and suggesting that the way you negotiate depends a lot on the form of the negotiation, the relationships you have with the other side, and the balance of power between them. I've told you a little bit about strategies, the need to be clear about your goals and your priorities, making sure that you choose between distributive and integrative bargaining approaches, ensuring that your behaviours align with those particular strategies. And finally, we've talked a little bit about tactics and the different sets of rules around information, pressure, and getting information which needs to guide you through the negotiating process. And with that, I'll stop. And if there are a few questions, for 5 minutes, I'm happy to answer those. So thank you for that.